faith in the news media has been challenged, making it even harder to get stories told. The Friday Reporter podcast was created to help audiences better understand the media by hosting journalists who will answer the questions to which we need answers. Join me every Friday to hear more. Well, hello, and thank you so much for joining me for another episode of the Friday Reporter podcast. Today's guest is a journalist that I have admired and worked with and known for some time, and I think is doing just some of the best, most relevant, most important work these days. Coral Davenport is the energy and environment policy correspondent for the New York Times, and she's with me today. Coral, thanks so much for being with me.
It is great to be with you, Lisa. It's great to be talking with you.
I have to ask, number one, the thing that I admire so much about the work that you do is that you have not only a great understanding of the intersection of the important issues you're talking about every day, but also like a really great depth of the policy and the intricacies as it relates to all of what's going on. Tell me, how did you get started in this business?
In journalism or in energy and environment?
Tell me.
It's two different. Those are two different stories. The second one is more interesting.
Tell me the more interesting one then. I'm for that.
Okay. Sure. So I was an English major in college. I went to college in Massachusetts. I started writing for my local paper straight out of school. Kind of thought I would like go to grad school and study Shakespeare, but just completely fell in love with just daily reporting. And a couple of years, and I was working in Western Massachusetts, and I was covering like zoning boards and planning boards and like school boards and all the things. And I loved it. And then I actually moved to Greece after a couple of years. I had lived there in high school. My father was a foreign service officer posted in Athens when I was in high school. Cool. And I spoke Greek and I knew people there and I, you know, didn't have any ties to keep me where I was. Mm-hmm. And so I moved to Athens and started freelancing. And there I covered like how Athens got ready for the 2004 Olympics. And I did a bunch of stories on terrorism. I did stories on how Greece got ready to get into the euro, which basically laid the foundation for its financial downfall many years later.
Yeah,
lots of I wrote stories. I wrote reviews of beaches. I did a lot of like travel writing. I was having a blast. I kind of thought I would sort of live this foreign correspondent life for quite a while, and then my parents, both of them, lived here in the DC area. My dad at that point was retired from the Foreign Service and they both got really sick. My dad had Parkinson's disease he was declining rapidly. My mom was taking care of him and she was not well. And it became clear that I had to move home and take care of them.
Yeah.
To DC. So I did, and I wasn't working. And I lived with them. I spent a year taking care of them. And it became clear that whatever I was going to do in my career, I had to be in DC.
Sure.
I had never covered policy. Because I had grown up in a US government family, I had adamantly refused to ever learn anything about how the government works.
Really?
Or policy or Congress. Or the branches, like beyond basic social studies. I was never going to live in DC, and I was never going to have anything to do in any capacity with like the USG or how it worked.
Yeah.
And now I was now I had to get a job as a journalist in DC.
Huh.
So and I had to do it. So I ended up getting, and I did all these interviews all over the place, and everyone said, you have these amazing clips and this international background. What do you know about policy? What do you know about the Hill? Crickets.
Yeah.
And so I ended up getting a fellowship at American University that they had for sort of like early mid-career journalists to basically kind of do an immersion in policy. kind of it. And they would, you know, I took a class on like on lobbying with, by the way, with people who worked with Jack Abramoff, which
oh,
was,
no way.
Yeah. Like this was like before all that went down.
Yeah.
Like I took a class in lobbying. I took, you know, classes in policy making. They, you know, they sent us out to the Hill. And that was the year that I did this was 2005. And as you will remember, Lisa, two big things in energy and climate policy happened that year. One, there was the 2005 energy law that passed. Mm-hmm. And then also there was Hurricane Katrina. And that like Katrina. And so those were just like, as I was kind of in Washington and feeling like I have to sort of do my homework and learn what's going on, suddenly that was like, you know, every this law was passing. And I was like talking to all of the policymakers who were writing it. And there was, you know, that was like when ethanol was like the big hot ethanol is going to save us all. We're all going to be driving our cars driven by fueled by corn. That was totally, there was a renewable fuel standard that was just, revelatory. And then Katrina hit. And it wasn't just that that was kind of this moment where people were saying, oh, does this have to do with climate change? It also knocked out like all of the Gulf Coast oil supply and, you know, sent gasoline prices skyrocketing, like, and sort of the, I had this moment of like, all of this is all tied in together. And it's also like this ping, it was like the Matrix, like, it was like the curtains open. And I was like, this is the bloodstream of the global economy.
Wow.
And, you know, kind of what happens with it is this is going to be the story of our time. And I just fell in love with it and kind of made it my beat while I was doing this fellowship. And it also became crystal clear to me that the center of the story was going to be policy and was going to be like what governments did, at the end of the day, we have people approach the idea of the environment as though it all comes down to, you know, this to individual action. And I'm not like against individual action, but I was like, this is the ultimate problem of the commons. This is not going to be solved by any one person or any one entity. It's all, so I just, I became addicted. I became so into this, what the story was. And I got a job covering, like I started working while I was doing this fellowship at Congressional Quarterly, mm-hmm. covering energy policy. And at the time, I don't think people realized that energy policy was climate policy, except for nerds. like people who were sort of, and the idea of a climate reporter that did not exist.
Yeah.
You know, that was not a thing.
No.
And so, I started getting into it, and then there were like more, then there was another big energy policy law in 2007. Can you imagine? What entity is this that passes like big bipartisan energy laws like every 2 years? Can you, what am I even talking about?
No, you're talking in Chinese to people who are new to this scene.
Like what? And then there was another one in 2006. There was like the Gulf bill with Mary Landrieu. Like what? Passing laws all the time. And that was really fun too, because I was at Congressional Quarterly and there were laws being passed and there was like legislation. And like, I swear to God, Lisa, there was bipartisanship and like John McCain was out there talking about climate change and we're all going to get this done. And like, and so it just felt like this was the problem of our time. And this was like the place that was going to solve it.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweitz, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery, And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
That was a long time ago.
It was. Oh my gosh, girl. I know. I feel like we've aged 1,000 years since those days, but it's so true. And I think that that's the one thing that over the course of our time, even from the time, you know, when you were getting started as a freelancer, like the world has changed so much, like the entry of social media and the entry of all of these other things that we're seeing every single day. I feel like some of it is actually quite good, especially on the beat that you cover, because so much of what you talk about in your reporting every day is affecting real people, whether it's flooding, whether it's heat, whether it's all of the things that are interconnected as it relates to how it affects us in our everyday lives. Social media, people have cameras in their homes. You can see more readily what it looks like. I mean, this will air a couple weeks from now, but right now, currently in the media, we're talking about this horrible tragedy that happened in Lahaina and on the island of Maui. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing so much of that. And a lot of it is like firsthand reporting, people that are not journalists reporting in on what's happening on the, you know, right there. So it's so interesting to me that it has changed so much even since you talk about 2005. And now here we are today, where you were one of the first, if not the first, climate reporter for the Times. Is that right?
Well, I got hired by the Times in 2013. Mm-hmm. And at the time, there was a climate science reporter, Justin Gillis. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. He's since left the Times. And then I was they had a slot for energy and environment reporter, policy reporter, which is still like my job. And I will tell you, Lisa, that, what happened was, the guy who had the job before me, John Broder, who you may remember,
I do.
He was going to, move to Paris. He was going to take a job in Paris. So the position was going to open up. And, you know, I was talking to people at the Times about it, and the editors I was talking to, said, you know, the thing is, it's not just that you would have to be competitive against, you know, other reporters for this job. It's that the management at the Times does not think there is any need to fill this job at all. Like, wow. That it is not understood why this is enough of a policy area or a beat that we should have anyone doing this. We have someone doing climate science. Why do you need more? When you come to the Times, when you're applying for a job at the Times, and they're taking you seriously, you write a memo and you say, this is what I would do, and these are stories, and this is how I would approach the beat. And I was basically told, like, your memo has to make a case for this beat existing at all.
Wow.
And that was not hard for me, because that was 2013. And I knew that was the era. Now we're fast forwarding in sort of the, you know, policy timeframe. That was when President Obama was coming in with his phone and pen and saying, you know, all right, I couldn't get anything passed in Congress, but I'm going to, you know, regulate the heck out of this. I'm going to basically flex the muscle of like executive authority in the EPA. Yeah. And that was a huge story, not just in terms of policy, but in terms of, you know, politically and, you know, in terms of how the role of the government and legally, I mean, that ended up being such a political flashpoint in so many ways. Those regulations just went to the Supreme Court last year. I mean, they have been, you know, this massive political flashpoint. So I came in and I was able to make the case for, like, this is why, you know, this is an essential policy and politics story. That was in 2013. But it wasn't. And then I ended up, you know, I was also able to say, look, there's so many, and this was kind of new. It was very new at that time to say there, we can now start to do stories about the impacts of climate change across the country in real time, and the economic impacts, in part because it was very new that we had attribution science. It was very new that, you know, scientists could say, well, this heat wave we now know was measurably made worse by climate change. That was all new.
Interesting.
And so you could, and that was, you know, it was just like every couple of years they would have one of those, but it was very new to be able to start to do that. And then, you know, in 2015, when there was the, you know, Paris Climate Accord, I think that was, the sort of first time that we saw these international climate, not just the annual climate negotiations, but the idea that this is an international policy and geopolitical story with tremendous trade and geopolitical interests, you know, and tensions between the global superpowers at play. Like, this isn't just like, oh, a fluffy, nice thing with, and so around, so while those stories were happening, 2015, 2016, the leadership of the time started talking, you know, went from why do we even need one person doing this to maybe we need a whole team.
I was going to ask. And, so how has yeah. that, yeah, that must have changed though.
Yeah. So that, so they started a climate team. I think it officially came together at the beginning of 2017.
Okay.
And maybe it was like 10 people then. And most of the people they brought in from other parts of the paper,
okay.
From other parts of the newsroom. Now, how many do we have? It's bigger. I mean, it keeps growing. It's probably 15 now,
okay.
Which is a small desk for the Times, but I mean, that is a 15-fold increase of, you know, reporters devoted to all the different facets of this. Or I guess, no, we had 2 reporters. Okay. So it's a 7-fold increase.
but still, and punching, you know, above your weight, like remarkable stories about that get really into it. They're not, you know, 500 words. They are really strong, well-sourced, well, you know, intersections with, you know, how it's going to affect. I think it's fantastic. And I think it's really just continuing to get better and better. And I appreciate it so much.
Well, and you know, now also, other major news organizations have followed suit, you know, the Post, the Washington Post has created its own climate desk, which I think they're saying they're going to have like 20 or 30 people. I don't think they're at that number yet, but, you know, that's a new thing as well. It was the Post. It was the same thing. You know, they had one person doing all of this. Now they have this desk that's growing and growing. Just the idea of like a climate reporter, like I said, like that wasn't a thing.
No.
You know, now people call themselves that. Now it's understood. Now general news organizations, you know, oh, we need a health reporter, we need a politics reporter, we need a tech reporter, and we need a climate reporter. So that has completely changed.
So much so.
And now major news organizations say, well, we need a climate team. And all of that is very new.
Yeah. It's amazing. It is so amazing. And I have to ask, because I mean, this summer alone has been really a reminder to all of us about how much and what is changing and different over time. I mean, the weather is obviously the earliest and most relevant indicator to all of us, but you cover a beat, Coral, that can be really, really heavy news, like a lot of really sort of worrisome kind of coverage that really can make people very, you know, concerned. Are there threads? Are there trends? Is there some, what kind of hope can you offer people? I'm not trying to say like anything has been solved at this point, but are you seeing the fact that newspapers in the U.S. are now having teams of journalists covering the issue? That alone tells me that there is an increased interest and perhaps importance that's been put on the issue itself.
So, it is very heavy, and it is the beat of like the great existential crisis of our time. And,
right.
And I will tell you that knowing it really well, like there right now, the science, everything that like the science and the analysis tell us is, you know, it's going to get a lot worse. We are probably, the world is not going to meet the targets. Right, like mathematically on paper right now, it's very hard to see how how the world meets the targets that it has set for itself to stave off catastrophe. So that's bad. However, I mean, Lisa, you have been in politics and policy for long enough to know that, like, stunning things that blow your mind that you never in a million years could have predicted happen all the time. Sometimes things happen so fast, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, and you know that in the world of policy in particular, like, things are an impasse and nothing is going to happen. And the conventional wisdom is like, nothing is going to happen and you won't get anywhere. And then everything transforms all at once yeah. on issues, you know, on issues across the spectrum. And right. one of the really interesting things that we're seeing and the analysts are telling us is sort of like in the world of the global energy economy is all of a sudden the acceleration of the clean energy transition. One example is, so like last year in the U.S., 6% of all new cars sold in the U.S. were electric vehicles. That is a very small number.
Yeah.
This year it's going to be 12%.
That's not nothing.
That's doubling.
Yeah.
That's a 100% increase.
Increase. Yeah.
You know, if you have like, if that rate increases, if it keeps up at that rate, potentially the transition to electric, and there are many things getting in the way. There are many obstacles to yeah. like the transition to electric vehicles, which I write about all the time. Mm-hmm. But you know, like in the clean energy transition, they always talk about, and I don't think this is the best metaphor, but it's the one we have, is like the iPhone moment, right? Where, you know, it goes like, there were, you know, people had cell phones, people had portable phones like for like 15 years mm-hmm. or more, maybe even 20 years, like before suddenly like there was the iPhone and then everything was, and then it was like ubiquitous. And now yeah. that's like what we do, you know? And for some of these technologies, the moment is coming where, you know, the breakthrough moment, it's not there yet, but it's coming so fast. And the speed of the transition, not necessarily in EVs, but like in wind and solar, the drop off in price has gone so fast. Like the price of solar is just like plummeting. Like you look at the cost lines and it's just like falling so fast. And the And now that companies have, you know, incentive, like the amount of money that they're using from the IRA is so much more than was predicted. And this is why Joe Manchin is mad about it. But, but to my point is like this clean energy transition that has just been sort of like going pretty slowly and kind of stop, start. And, you know, because had kind of always been just around the corner for like as long as I've covered this for 20 years,
I bet,
is now going much faster. Like it is accelerating really, really fast. That is not enough on its own. But if you look at, yeah, that's not enough on its own to like reduce carbon emissions at the rate that it needs to happen. But it's happening a lot faster than sort of anyone would have thought it would have at this point.
That's
so, cool. You know, you look at that and you say, okay, you know, I would not have thought that, I mean, if EV sales went up 100% in 1 year, if they go up only 50% a year over year for the next few years after that, like that is a big, big jump.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of trends that we are seeing across all forms of zero carbon energy. So that's interesting to see. And it reminds me that like in this world where of know-it-alls who always know what's going to happen and always say, well, that's never going to happen, or you're a cockeyed optimist or whatever, we don't know.
Yeah. What kinds of things, people must ask you, what kinds of things can we be doing in our own homes? Like, are there things that you say like, oh yeah, I do that now in my house because I think that that's better for the environment? Are there, not to put you on the spot, but I'm curious, like people ask all the time, like, you know, what can we ourselves be doing while corporations and everyone else has an obligation to also be meeting these goals? What kinds of things can regular consumers be doing, regular people be doing?
So I am absolutely not a pimp for the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, mm-hmm. Which is the climate and spending law that Biden signed last year. But a big chunk of it is free money for homeowners. You know, there is so much money. And if you go to like the IRS website, so here's what I would say is like, if you are, and unfortunately it's really only for homeowners. Mm-hmm. But if you want to make improvements in your home right now, you should be sucking up all that. You should get the government to pay you to do it. So the IRA can give you gigantic tax credits to do stuff like install a way more efficient HVAC system that would use much, much, much less electricity to run. Hmm. If you want to completely reinstall, like take out your old HVAC and put in a new, much more efficient one, the government will basically give you thousands of dollars of free money to do that. You have to like work with your contractor, document it all and get the forms from the IRS. And then you get lots of money back.
Wow.
Like in your taxes. So mm-hmm. another one that the government will give you free money to do is swap out your gas stove for an induction stove, which a couple years ago, I myself would have said, you can pry my gas stove out of my dead hands. But now Allison Roman has one and she loves it. So now like induction stoves are supposed to work even better than gas stoves. And they don't, you know, they do not emit fossil fuels. So those kinds of changes done, I mean, that's the problem with climate change is like individual action doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But that's why all this free money is in that law, is to get it done, you know, at a very wide scale. So sure. There is, and so like what someone can do is like literally go to the IRS and look at like the benefits for homeowners and then like use it to get the government to pay you to do any kind of energy efficient home improvement that would cause your home to consume less electricity. I mean, that's the point of it. And you and the government will pay you to do that.
That's great advice. That's great advice. I have an induction stove. I think it's pretty great. I got to tell you.
Oh, when did you get it? Did you get IRA money for it?
No. I bought it before, but I was renovating my house at the time. And I was like, everybody's like gas stove, gas stove, gas stove. And I was like, I don't know. I mean, I like an electric stove. I was like, what about induction? Talk about boiling water in about 32 seconds. I mean, it is so, it's cool. It's a cool, I love it. That's great advice and super good advice. I love talking to you about this too, Coral, because like you're so passionate about it, but you also really have some good, interesting insights. While yes, of course, one individual action cannot make a change, multiple individual actions will definitely actually affect some. And mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, it's, action is action, right? So moving in the right direction. I can't believe it, but we're already at 30 minutes. And this is always just sort of the thing about these conversations with all my friends that I enjoy talking to so much. Tell me, this is the fastest summer on record. I swear I'm looking up and it's almost September. Have you done anything great over the summer? Have you had a chance to get away?
I haven't. I am about to take a 2-week staycation with my husband and my almost 6-year-old.
Awesome.
And he's about to switch from like a little bitty private tiny Montessori school to public school.
How big? That's a big move.
Yeah. And so I thought, you know, I mean, when I was growing up, we just like, I didn't want to take a big trip and come back and then be like, and now you're starting public school. I was like, let's like stay home and go to the pool and be bored and watch the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie.
I love it.
So it's not very exciting. We took some big trips in winter, but I'm actually, I mean, Lisa, you know how it is with kids. Like wouldn't you love 2 weeks where your whole family did not have to work or go to school? Yes. And there was like nothing on the calendar?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like, it feels very exciting to me.
It's, but you know what? It's so funny. Cause like I typically ask this question cause you know, everybody always says to you as you're like headed to the dentist or you're at the beginning of the summer, like, oh, what are your big summer plans? The truth is sometimes we have big plans in the summer and sometimes we just stay home. And it's just nice to be in your house and not have to worry about sort of hustling and bustling and being where you go to the pool, catch up on your great shows, read a couple of great books and just like recharge your batteries. So I get that. And it surprises me always how many people I talk to in our world that are like, no, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to be right here. I have a stack of books that I've been promising myself I'm going to read and that's what I'm going to do. So that's amazing. Okay. So as we arrive at the final question of our conversation today, I have to ask, who should I talk to for a future episode?
So my favorite journalist is my work wife, Lisa Friedman. She covers the same things that I do, but she is completely different and comes from a completely different background. And I think if you were to ask her these questions, she would have a completely different set of answers.
I love it.
So we're like, we tell our sources, like, we're like one monster with two heads. and yet like Lisa brings this super international background.
I love that.
She knows sort of the international world. She like really came from the world of climate reporting, but she's also like, I think I won't tell you how she got into, journalism, but it definitely involves many murders.
Oh my gosh. Okay, cool. Well, she's on the list. That's it. Okay. I love it. And you know how this goes. I mean, the truth is that the only way the show keeps going is if I get recommendations from one to the next. And it's kept the show going now for, I mean, I'm going on 130 episodes. So it's been a ton of fun.
Fantastic. Well,
Coral, I'm so super grateful for your time. Enjoy the rest of your summer. And I will share this. I can't wait to get it out into the world. And I look forward to following your coverage as it evolves over time again and again, my friend.
Okay. Thank you so much. I hope you enjoy the rest of your summer as well.
And that's today's Friday Reporter podcast, a podcast in partnership with PR Daily, a tremendous and helpful guide for all things public relations. Find us there on their website and join us again for another episode soon. Thanks so much.